And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
And good evening and welcome to Chatter on Books. What episode is this? 270?
273 or 23rd.
Is it 24?
Walker's birthday.
Yeah. A great lamented
not
show.
Not today, but the
bad
24th.
Show.
Excellent.
In retrospect.
Yes. But welcome, everybody. A gorgeous day here in the nation's capital.
Yes.
At Chatter, on the corner of Jennifer and Wisconsin Avenues, we are very, very happy to be here with Mark Stern, who is bright pink. Bright, bright, bright pink. He's playing injured. He's playing injured, so we love that.
Appreciate
we appreciate that.
Yes.
Michael Kornheiser, Jeannie McManus, David Aldridge, I'm Tori Clark. We are really, really thrilled to be here tonight to talk about an amazing book by Abby Maslin, who is here with us, a DC teacher. We love that. And she has written a book called Love You Hard, a memoir of marriage, brain injury, and reinventing love. And I think we all trained in Texas this week. We talked before the show started. Just a remarkable, remarkable book. And a remarkable story. So that will be great. And we're going to do a little segment called Calling Dr. Freud. We find out that Dr. Freud might have been a fake and gotten all his good ideas from books he read.
No!
Yes! And in our Deserted Island segment, because this is the anniversary of the Hindenburg, we're going to talk about books about disasters. But first, a little housekeeping. We are at Chatter, and Mother's Day is coming up.
It's next Sunday.
Next Sunday. There's a lobster-inspired weekend. Liz was in here before telling us about the lobster-inspired weekend. There's a prefix, which is pretty remarkable, that includes bisque and Caesar salads and seafood pastas and stuffed lobster tails. You can also do a la carte, which is pretty remarkable. I was looking at the lobster Benedict myself.
But it looks delicious.
Yeah. And I can speak from personal experience because I was here, I think, last year for Mother's Day with our friends, and it was lovely. And mothers get a glass of bubbly.
There you go.
And I think there's no ID required, Michael, for determining who's a mother. So pretty much any woman who walks in could maybe get a free glass of bubbly. Okay, great.
We'll judge here at Chatter.
Yeah. Was over visiting Michael Sands at CW, our wonderful sponsor CW, which is over on Connecticut Avenue, and you should go there and use Chatter 5 at checkout, and you'll get $5 off. And Jeannie, you have to help me with this because I will mispronounce the names again. But we have a lovely red wine called L'Amarette.
L'Amarette.
Yeah, which is a French wine. Jeannie, what do you think this, what's your reaction so far?
It is very full-bodied. I think I read somewhere that it goes well with beef and veal, and I
see
can
that.
Definitely
see that.
Yeah,
I want to have a steak right now.
It is from the Thunavin Calvet Winery, 14.5% alcohol,
Hello.
Which to me sounds
go for it.
Healthy, right?
Yeah.
If you're going to drink, you might as well.
Big one.
Yeah. Yeah, big, sweet, jammy fruit is what one reviewer said.
Yes, that's
but
true.
But really good. Michael has never given us anything other than exceptional wine, which is
big,
really good.
Big, sweet, jammy fruit open for Talking Heads back in 87.
They did. I was there.
Yeah,
I hope so.
I was there.
And Abraham gave us a lovely cheese, which did not have a name on it, but Michael Sands declared it his favorite cheese ever.
It reminds me of Saint-André.
Yeah.
Or one of those wonderful, creamy,
yeah, really wonderful
cheeses.
La Cheeserie, which everybody knows, is getting ready for Jingle Fest. They were literally in there talking about the numbers of people and
that
the folks are going to show up in the busloads.
Summer, as usual.
Third week of June.
Is it third week of June? All right.
Yeah, June 22nd.
I might actually be able to make that this year.
That's right.
You know,
you won't be at the NBA finals.
I won't be at the finals for the first time in, literally, 20 years.
That's good for us.
20 years.
It is good for us.
Yes.
And Jeannie, you and I are going to talk about a new feature we have coming up.
Yes.
Book club therapy.
Uh-oh. Book club therapy. So Tori and I have both heard from various people about their...
We don't do this, but we've heard.
Yes. It's like sounds like our president. People are saying that certain issues come up in book club. And book clubs are like any groups. I mean, they're often unable to deal with sort of thorns that are sitting there in the room. And so I talked to some people about the things that go wrong in their club. One was somebody habitually doesn't read the book, and that's annoying, especially in a small group.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody reads half of the book and then
that's
thinks
me.
They can offer full-throated criticism,
sure.
not having known how the book develops. Worse, they haven't read the book and beg you not to talk about the ending so it doesn't ruin the book
the
for
spoilers.
Them when they
nice.
Finally get around to
nice.
Reading it. I think that's the worst
yeah.
sin of all. And then what are the annoying things that annoying book club members do. The big one I heard was somebody is always too didactic. Well, you may not know this, but somebody has done her background reading and her context and, like, lays it on thick to the others who, like, as if they're dumb coughs.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Another one, and I have to say, I heard this once myself. I'm a book club dropout.
Which is one of the reasons we like you.
Book club survivor, we like to think of.
No graduation date.
BKS.
I haven't read this book, but my husband really likes it.
Oh, the worst.
I just wanted to shoot her.
Yeah.
So here's some survival tips that I learned. No one is allowed to say they hate the book in the first 15 minutes so as not to stifle discussion. If you come in and you just do not like the book, keep your yap shut, let other people talk, and then bring it on, okay? But don't start off right away. And then another thing, agree on consistent amenities. Will wine be served? Will wine not be served? As for me, if it's not being served, I'm not
no
there,
being there,
okay?
Yeah.
But are you going to have snacks? Are you going to have dessert? Don't change it up and have people coming in and wondering, you know, am I going to, you know, be starving? And have some organized plan for how to choose the next book, whether it's a rotation, whether you should vote, whether everybody should bring a recommendation and then vote amongst that. But have a plan. Don't just have it turn into a free-for-all about what the next book should be.
Isn't it amazing that you need to come up with these rules?
You need rules.
Yes.
But
and that,
you
know,
should see them as creating norms that can create any healthy community.
Okay, mm-hmm. Well, great segue to our segment, which we're going to call Book Club Therapy, because I haven't come up with a better name. People can send in to Tori@chatteronbooks.com. That's T-O-R-I-E. Their complaints, their concerns, their questions, their issues. And
there
we'll
are
try,
no complaints.
And we'll try to, about book clubs.
Book clubs.
And we'll resolve them for them.
Things can get pretty testy in book clubs, from what I'm told.
I was chatting with some lovely people out here before the show. I was visiting East City Bookshop up on Capitol Hill. Everyone should go there. Lovely independent bookstore. They host book clubs in their bookshop. Mm-hmm. And the reason they do it is because these book clubs told them that their book clubs had become so angst-ridden, and there were so many fights, and there were so many disagreements about things like this. They needed somebody to MC for them.
Right.
So we can provide some of that comfort.
And
some
you
of
will
sauce.
Remain anonymous.
Yes.
We will not blow your cover.
And book clubs can come here to chatter.
Sure, they can have their book clubs here.
That's right.
Have some food?
There was a little conversation about that before the show.
Absolutely.
But your concerns, your questions, your problems, your challenges, Tori@chatteronbooks.com.
There you go.
Think of her as sort of like the Dear Abby of books.
Yes.
Exactly.
It's
a whole new,
and like any group, you always end up with a couple of bad contracts. There's always one or two voices you want to kick out of book club, but it's too public to remove them from the email.
Good point. But you can solve that by having a letter wrong on their email. Just... Oh, I thought you were,
you know,
I thought there was an E on the name, end of your name. No, really?
I think it's always good to have one person in the group that everyone hates. I think it's
kind of
good
like
galvanizing effect for the rest of the book.
Why do you think I'm here?
We love you because you're playing injured.
Exactly.
Which
That's
is
right.
so
and
great.
I was all set to be the disappointed school marm today when we talk about your book review.
Well, I've got a book report.
Right.
Report.
Right.
Report on the report.
Yeah, report on the report. But there we see something in there.
You are a decent person, aren't you?
It's like the government, right? You can't fail. Mm-hmm. You can't. But if you gave me a deadline, I would meet it. But now I've created my own. But before we get to that, because we always say the show is about books, but it's about many things, we have to talk about the Kentucky Derby.
Okay.
First time ever a horse who has won the Kentucky Derby in the context of the race itself mm-hmm. has been disqualified.
That's right.
Years ago, a horse got disqualified weeks later because of drugs.
Yes, they were using an then illegal drug, but is now a legal drug.
This was remarkable. So Maxim Security leads from wire to finish. Everybody's happy. Everybody's around the horse. He's mm-hmm. excited. The jockey's excited. The owner's and then that challenge goes up.
Yep.
And quite the controversy.
Yep.
David, I saw you tweeting about this, and one thing that you pointed out was the lack of transparency.
Oh, yes, about the press conference.
There wasn't a press conference.
There wasn't a press conference. It was a statement.
Yeah.
We'll take no questions.
A statement put out by one steward of the three who reviewed it.
Yeah. I just thought that was kind of bizarre, and I don't know anything about horse racing etiquette, protocol, history. I have no frame of reference to that at all. It just seemed to me somewhat odd that you would come out and just say what you did when you disqualified a horse who won the Kentucky Derby for the first time in 145 years, and you wouldn't take any questions. That just seems kind of odd to me. Like, I would think, just so that you could explain it to people, so that they would understand what you did, you wouldn't want to take questions.
Wasn't there a responsibility on the part of the network, in this case NBC, to do that, some of that?
Yes, but...
They weren't prepared for it.
Well, I don't know if they were or weren't prepared for it, but it's a show that has to go off at a certain period of time. They came out at, I want to say, an hour and a half after the race was over.
Bumping into hockey.
With their statement. So you're right, Tori. NBC certainly could have stayed in place. They could have demanded one of those stewards, there was three of them, come on camera and explain themselves. That is where I get back to, the protocols and the history, is this like the Masters where you can't say anything about the tournament? Otherwise, you don't get to host the tournament the next year. Or is it, you know, or is it somewhere in between? Or is I certainly, my newspaper journalism background would have led me to demand some answers.
But Sally Jenkins, as ever, gets to the important thing here.
Yeah.
The absolutely miraculous, thank God it didn't happen, point of her story was, and some people said this, is that these horses they're going 40 miles an hour. They weigh 1,200 pounds.
Right.
Their legs are thrashing into one another. The fact that none of them went down and killed themselves, killed their jockeys, was a miracle. So there's that. And what's really going on in racing is the safety of the sport. These horses get drugged. They get run when they shouldn't be run. Right. Horses are breaking down all the time. What's going on at Santa Anita? And she got to the heart of that. So in a way, they dodged a bullet.
They absolutely dodged a bullet.
Yeah, really.
They showed
really
the tape of Maximum Security, and I can't remember the name of the horse he clipped, but he clipped a horse.
Sure.
I mean, he literally ran on the back legs of another horse. And it's very easy for those horses to go down, even when they're under the control of these amazing jockeys who keep them upright. And I felt so bad for the jockey who was on Maximum Security because he didn't lie. He said, my horse got scared.
That's right, yeah.
And he veered off. I know he did.
He jumped a puddle or something.
Yeah.
I was persuaded by the trainers who said, they were trying to get anybody to say anything on camera. The trainers who said, look, if this was a maiden claiming race, in Charlestown, West Virginia, that horse would have been disqualified right away.
Sure.
And what they were trying to weigh was, it's the Kentucky Derby. But the rules need to be the rules. And Sally said it.
You went four wide. You can't go four wide.
One of the saddest things, I know Maximum Security did not feel this way, but these are, I know just enough to be dangerous, right? These are three-year-olds. That is very young. They are very, very temperamental. They're stallions, right? And they've never seen crowds like this and noise.
Yeah.
And so they are just, the adrenaline is insane. And so you always see it, the horse finishes the race, and he's galloping, and he comes into the winner's circle, and he's just standing up on tiptoes and so excited. And because it took 22 minutes, and they're just walking him around, and he is gassed. Right, he has given his all on the track, and he is gassed. And finally, they decide the other horses run, who's brought back out, and poor Maximum Security gets walked back to his stall all by himself.
Yeah.
No crowds, nobody.
Yeah.
I think he knew. Okay. All right. So, book report, which will be very, very brief.
Oh dear.
I now, of the 90 or 100 or so people who voted on which book I should do, I really resent every single one of them. Because having read the book and then reread the book, Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, it's one of the most remarkable things I've ever read, not just the content, but how he wrote it. So it's really, really malpractice for me to even be talking about his book, much less talking about how he wrote it. But I've gone through what I wanted to say, and now I am working on what I want to say and how I want to say it, and I will do it next Monday.
Yay.
Oh.
Yay.
But it's a remarkable book, and I will, teaser alert, read, if you didn't read Fred Hyatt's piece today on what's going on with white extremists and what is going on in this country, you should read that piece, because I had some similar thoughts, not as brilliantly put as Freddie's, but it's related. But just a remarkable
next
book.
Next week.
So there we go. Next week,
Professor
that's it.
Stern is late. Is at the ready.
Yeah. And then I get to pick somebody else for book report.
Yes, not me.
Well, mine. Yeah, not me or me. Or David,
Okay, now we're going to shift to calling Dr. Freud, and it would be his birthday today. It would be his birthday, so happy birthday, Dr. Freud.
Happy birthday.
And just course, going to my Google machine and reading about him, and I, you know, and I put in Dr. Freud in books, and he was well known for talking about the books that influenced him heavily. And I was really surprised at some of the picks. I wasn't surprised by Paradise Lost. That's kind of okay. Anybody who's into what Freud was into would say that, right? But Jungle Book, think about that. A little bit darker than Disney put it, right? The Brothers Karamazov, which he declared, Freud declared, was the most magnificent novel ever written. And David Copperfield. And he gave a copy of David Copperfield to his fiancée on the day he proposed to her.
Okay.
What kind of gift is that? Like, Brian got me a beer. But now I'm beginning to think, as I said to Jeannie, and I'll throw this open to you guys. I think, who knows, and Jeannie, your point about there wasn't a lot going on in psychoanalysis at the time, maybe he got a lot of ideas from these books.
Well, I thought about these books, and many of them, there are archetypes of human behavior. I mean, Paradise Lost is the most obvious. Adam, Eve, and Satan. And so, you know, if you're, I mean, this is so shallow, but if you're analyzing personalities, you know, I think one way you start is by sort of getting, okay, what's the core here? Are you Adam, are you Eve, or are you Satan? And then just kind of expand from there. As with Mowgli in Jungle Boy, I mean, here's a wild, unfettered, you know, animal child.
Being molded.
Being molded, and being molded by society and the jungle, sort of which is going to win and which is going to lose. And I mean, even David Copperfield with its sort of abandoned child, abused child, that each of those could have been a patient sitting in Freud's chair.
Yeah.
That when he would have read one of these books, he would have said, okay, this is like Adam. The thing that really interested me was Paradise Lost, because Freud was, to many people, not a great friend to women, that he did not recognize that women had sexuality. And in Paradise Lost, Adam and Eve get it on. So that's kind
why
of
we're all here.
Surprised. Yes, exactly. That kind of surprised
me. Prerequisite, right?
So that is how, when I looked at this book, that's how I thought of it.
I was just so struck by, if you didn't know when these books were written, you go, oh, they were all influenced by Freud, right? Everybody's influenced by Freud. He's the great influencer. He's the original influential, right? Then you go, maybe not. Michael, was he the teacher or was he taught by?
I don't think there's anything wrong with being taught by in these situations. I take a look at the last two books that you mentioned, and you take a look at setting. Jeannie did a great look into the characterization of these archetypes, and I think if you just look at the breadth of characters in any Dickens novel, you're going to see the best and worst about all of us. And so much of when we dive into a novel, we want to take a look at that mirror and see the best of ourselves, the worst of our neighbors, and sort of the worst of the world at large. But in terms of setting, you're seeing the strict social setting rules that are in place in Brothers Karamazov as well as in David Copperfield. And that is going to be the system through which you're going to learn a lot more about the why, as to why these characters, why we ourselves are acting a certain way, which is, I think, a missing ingredient as to why when we are going to psychoanalyze anybody. But also, if you just take a look at the basic levels of conflict, you know, self to self, self versus somebody else, self versus this world, you're going to get all those interactions, particularly in those two books.
Yeah. Quick commercial break. I was in a bar in Lexington, Virginia this weekend prior to the Derby.
Talking about Freud.
About Freud. And minding my own business, talking to my friends about the race coming up. And somebody says, are you Tori Clark? Because they heard my voice, Donald Duck on Helium.
Stop.
And I said, yeah. And they looked like a normal person. So I acknowledged, yes. And they talked to me for 20 minutes about Michael Kornheiser. He's so smart. He's so smart. I don't really read books, but when he talks about books, I think I should read that book.
All misdirection.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The teacher in the room would recognize it. Good teaching is all about misdirection.
There you go. David,
reframe it to something you know.
Any thoughts on Dr. Freud?
I was very taken by the other books that you mentioned. Another book that you mentioned was Mark Twain.
Yeah.
We also spend a lot of time on. And certainly from a contemporary standpoint.
That was a real surprise.
Was it really? I didn't think so. For a late 18th century person trying to understand the human condition, having the
most known and most celebrated satirist of that time, I think would make a lot of sense to understand kind of the absurdity of human behavior. You know, because if you think about it, what Freud was spent a lot of time talking about, most people would think of as kind of silly and abstract and absurd, even though it's very central to our being as people. But having Mark Twain in there for the laughs, for another way of saying it, made a lot of sense to me. Now, having said that, as I told you before, this is reminding me a lot of William Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And where we now believe, I think a lot of people believe, William Shakespeare borrowed a lot of ideas from a lot of different people, a lot of contemporaries at
the time. Sort of the epitome of there's no original idea.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. We're all just reinventing the wheel.
Exactly.
Okay. Now we're going to take a quick break. We're going to put a little aloe on Mark's face.
Mark's going to hydrate.
Mark's going to hydrate. And we will come back with Abby Maslin, remarkable author. Chatter on Books, and we are back with our featured author of the week, Abby Maslin, who has written a remarkable book called Love You Hard, and it is a memoir of marriage and brain injury and reinventing love. Abby, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
First, I know you've been on a big media tour, first one in a bar, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm thinking back, it is.
All right, so let's go back to the beginning. I'll do a little bit of a setup here. But what got you on this path and got you writing this book? You and your husband, TC, a lot of us, boy, Jeannie and David, born and raised in D.C. Mm-hmm. I've been here for 1,000 years. But you guys were the quintessential Washington couple, young, doing jobs, work you loved, you have a baby, everything is great. So take us back. I'm sure it is still hard, but take us back to what happened in August in 2012.
Sure. So my husband and I moved to Capitol Hill in 2009. We moved just a couple weeks before we got married, actually. And in 2012, we were still kind of in that honeymoon era or phase of marriage. We'd been married for just exactly 3 years. We were the parents to an almost 2-year-old. We were settled into jobs that we loved dearly. I was working at a DC public school that I loved being at, and he was just a rising superstar in the renewable energy field. So he was working in the consultation area of, you know, advising companies what to invest in renewables. We were kind of in that phase of life where it feels like everything is just right in front of you and it is all sunshine and it is all roses, and it's going to be that way indefinitely because now you've earned it. You've paid your dues. You went to school. You're paying off the student loans. You found your partner, all of that good stuff. And on the morning of August 18th, 2012, I woke up and I was alone. My husband had gone to a Nationals baseball game the night before and he never came back. And I was just thrown into an absolute nightmare, and spent several hours just trying to figure out where he might be. And it wasn't, you know, actually the pieces didn't come together for weeks. But what had happened is that he had been assaulted on his walk home, just a short walk, just a few blocks from our house, hit with a baseball bat and left for dead. And he wasn't found for 8 hours. So by the time he got help and he got to the hospital, he was nearly gone. He was really, really lucky to have a neurosurgeon who happened to be at Washington Hospital Center that day who was able to operate on him. And then when I was able to get there a few hours earlier after kind of putting the pieces together, I just had to make sense of a life that had been completely upended, completely shattered. And the future was terribly uncertain. It was unclear whether he was going to live, and if he did live, what that life would look like.
You were a teacher, and you had to draw upon those skills to help him get through this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had gone to graduate school first to be a therapist. So all this Freudian talk is, you know, starting to ring bells for me. I went to school to be a creative arts therapist, a movement therapist, and I was working with kids on the autism spectrum who are nonverbal, and decided I wanted to be a full-time teacher, so went back to grad school again and was actually halfway through when this happened. I was a student at American University. And I was teaching fourth grade and never imagined that these skills that I had been acquiring for years, these skills in the classroom, these skills working with special needs kids, that I would suddenly be called upon to use them in just a completely unexpected way, that I would be helping to rehabilitate my husband. And thank God I had acquired all those student loans and spent all that time.
You had
We made flowcharts. When your life is shattered, one of the first things you lose is your sense of purpose, right? Like, what am I doing here? How am I supposed to spend my time? When TC got out of the hospital, it was after almost 4 months. And we got home and we just looked at each other like, what are we supposed to do now? Neither one of us can work. I was his full-time caregiver. The only thing that occurred to me is that I am here in this moment to help rehabilitate him. And his dream at that point, he was barely able to talk, was to go back to work. And that seemed like a huge, just a huge dream at that point. But I knew that our time was better spent working toward a really, really far-fetched dream than to sit there thinking about the lives that we had lost.
Tell us a little bit about the kind of guy that TC is.
So he is the most tenacious human being I have ever met. In writing this book, I had to be careful because I knew he was coming off pretty perfect, but he was kind of obnoxiously perfect. when I met him, I was shocked. Who can this person be real? He grew up in a situation that was difficult. He came from very little. He was the first person in his family to go to college. He put himself through college, put himself through graduate school. Just relentlessly hardworking and kind of serious. And I think you have to be in order to achieve all that. Because he knew what it was like to live a life of instability, and he never wanted to have that. He definitely didn't want to have that for his son. Thank goodness that's the kind of man he was, because I knew, you know, even with a brain injury and so much is uncertain, that if he were able to call upon that kind of work ethic and that kind of commitment and tenacity that he had had for his entire life, that there was a chance he was going to make it out of this and he was going to do okay. And he really, really was able to do that. So his ambition, you know, just got translated into a different kind of ambition. His ambition after this injury was just to have an ordinary life again, to go back to work. And to be a dad.
But nothing ordinary about it for you.
Nothing ordinary about it for me. I think, you know, I'm sure I had heard the term brain injury a dozen times in my life. I did not hear it for the first time until that day. I never thought I would be in this situation. And, you know, part of that was just I had told myself a lot of tales about how life goes when we follow the rules and when we kind of buy into a system where it's supposed to guarantee our future happiness. And I really believed in that. I really thought I was paying my dues all along and discovered that that's just not how life works. That was a pretty privileged position privileged kind of perspective that I had. And that life is random. And it's beautiful in that sense, and it's terrifying in that sense. And so something we do every day as humans is we wake up and we acknowledge that we are not in control of everything. And we're going to have to walk through this world just trying to make sense of that, to be okay with it, and to live in that uncertainty. So for me, it was a real journey of uncertainty and learning to make peace with that.
And it wasn't just about TC. I was talking with some of your fans out there before the show. I read the book, and I'm listening to the book, and you have TC going through this and how your life has been completely upended. Your father is very sick and dies, and your mother gets breast cancer.
Yeah, it was a triple.
I'm listening to it in the car going, I'm yelling out loud going, when does she get a break?
I hear that things happen in threes. That was certainly true for me.
Those are three big ones.
You know, caregiving is a lonely business to begin with. And for me, it was excruciatingly lonely because I was the mother of a two-year-old who was barely talking at the time. And then I was taking care of three adults who were really unable to be there for me, too. So I felt like I was on my own. I really did feel that way. And, you know, that was the moment when my mom, especially when she got sick and was diagnosed with breast cancer, it was about 5 or 6 months after TC's assault. And I just realized I have a choice to make right now. I am going to sink into the greatest depression of my life, or I'm going to use this as a reminder to take care of myself, because I really hadn't been taking care of myself since the day of that assault. And I'm going to fight my way out of this because these people depend on me and I have no choice but to be there for them.
Jean, you and I were talking before the show about the actual writing and the process of the writing.
Yeah, I mean, Abby, the honesty of your writing, of telling this story, of talking about how angry you were, how angry TC was, how isolated you were from each other. I mean, you express things that I think many, many people in your situation would be loath to express. And I wondered, because this book sprang from a blog, that honesty that you were spilling out diary-like every day or week or whatever, it contributed to this honesty that at the time you weren't thinking I got to hold back here. I can't let people know what's really on my mind. That when you went to assemble a book from that blog, that honesty was so undeniable that it had to be in the book.
Yeah, you know, there's a beautiful thing that happens when everything kind of falls apart. You are free. And I didn't have anything to lose by being that honest. I really didn't. I sat down to write my first blog about this experience about 10 days into it. And I sat down with two intentions. And one was to really let people know what this was like, because it was such a nightmare, and it was just almost impossible to put words around it. And I wanted people to know how this felt. But the second was to let people know who TC was, because yes, he was only 29 years old. And if he didn't make it out, if he didn't live through this, even if he did and he was completely changed, I wanted the world to know what man I had married, because I loved him so much. I was so proud of him. I couldn't stand the idea that he might not be here and people might not know what he was to me. And that love and that inspiration is what drove this book. And, you know, this book challenged me in so many ways. And one way it challenged me was just to really think about what it means to be in love, what love is. And I thought I loved TC as much as I possibly could before this happened. But so much of what I loved about him was how it made me feel. And when love can't be reciprocated in that same way, and it certainly couldn't after his injury, he was unable to communicate with me. You have to look for something else. You have to say, I'm standing here for a reason with this individual. What is it about this individual that I find so remarkable? And for me, it was that drive. It was his will to live that I found just so incredibly beautiful, and that I continue to find so beautiful. I'm just lucky I get to live with him every day.
You talk so beautifully in your book about something that every married couple at some point has to come to grips with. Every single one. Me too. I've been married twice as long as you've been married. And it's not something that happens once. It happens over and over again. And that is, why am I still married to this person?
Right.
Why?
Right.
I mean, literally, why am I still here?
Right.
And I wonder what that journey was like to kind of figure out the answer to that over and over again.
Right. So, I mean, part of my, I think, original view of marriage was that it was supposed to be stagnant in some way. Mm-hmm. That the people that you were on your wedding day, you were going to still be those people into the future. And now I think love is synonymous with change. It is change. You are agreeing in marriage that you are going to evolve together. And you are going to work really hard to evolve in a way that allows you to be good partners to each other. Mm-hmm. So this just completely blew up my idea of what that was. And I also kind of had this sense that love was supposed to be intuitive, and you were supposed to be able to just guess what your partner wanted. And if your partner couldn't do that for you, that maybe that wasn't true love. And that it was like two individuals becoming one. And I don't believe that anymore. I think marriage is an incredible thing. I think it's a great choice for some people. I think it's a choice you make every single day. And I think at the end of the day, you're still an individual. Mm-hmm. And your understanding of yourself, your relationship with yourself is what is going to sustain your marriage.
What was the hardest part to write about in this book? Because you go into incredible details. I felt a little bit, when I was reading it and listening to it, I felt a little bit like I felt about reading Unbroken. Remember Hillenbrand's
mm-hmm.
book, right?
Yeah.
Where you think, God, the worst possible thing, getting shot down, captured by the Japanese. Yeah. No, that wasn't the worst thing in his life. Right? It gets on. What was the hardest part to write about? Was it his injury and the recovery from it? Was it your marriage? What was the hardest part?
It was losing my dad. It wasn't about TC at all. You know, that might surprise people, but by the time I lost my father, it was 18 months after TC's injury. I was so numbed out. I had been on just such an emotional roller coaster. I knew I couldn't sustain that kind of up and down every day, and I really numbed myself to his death. And in writing about it, it was a reopening of that wound. But also just making peace with it and being able to appreciate somebody who couldn't be there for me at the end of his life, but had been there for me for decades before that.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the you did a wonderful celebration of his life, which again, by the end of the book, I am drained. I don't know how you wrote this. I was a puddle.
Me too.
I'm screaming out loud in my car, and I'm a puddle. And your description of the celebration of your dad's life made me go, okay, we can make it here.
We can. Yeah, my dad, Marty Sullivan, he was a D.C. guy. Yeah, he spent all his bachelor years here. There were a lot of those years. And then he got his dream job as a director of the National Portrait Gallery near the end of his life. And he was a man who, I mean, he was the man who taught me what to look for in a man without ever telling me any advice in words. But we celebrated his life on the bank of the St. Mary's River, which is where TC and I were married in Southern Maryland. And it was a real celebration, you know. The word death is just seems to just bring up, you know, thoughts about blackness and gloom and all of that. But my dad had a great life, and we wanted to celebrate it in a great, joyful way. And in some ways, his death, for me, felt like a new beginning. We had just been living in this gray space of just chronic illness and sickness for so many years. When he passed, and on the day he passed, there was just this tremendous rainbow that appeared after his ceremony. I just felt like he's here, and this is our permission that we're going to start again, that we're still alive. Because if anything, this adventure, this journey, this has just woken me up to my life. This was just my wake-up call. To say, you're here. You don't know how much time you get, and you better make use of each one of these days because you're here for a reason.
So, Abby, you talked a little bit. You got some counseling along the way, but not a lot. How do you have such incredible self-knowledge and such a well-grounded view of what's happened to you?
Thank you for that compliment. You should probably just shout out my mom right now.
Is because that it? Yeah.
So I don't get in trouble later. No, I mean, I had a really wonderful childhood, which really helped, right? Because I knew what to work for. I knew that there was something that was worth fighting for because I had lived it for a really long time. But the writing part, the writing process, that is really where I made sense of everything. That is how I worked it out. Every sentence in this book was written at least six times. Because I wrote it, and then I asked myself, is that the truth, or is there a deeper truth underneath that? And is there another truth underneath that? And I tried to get at what was really real in this experience, because I knew that ultimately this wasn't a book just about TC and I and this event. This was a book about the human experience and living through suffering and finding joy. And if I couldn't get at those universal nuggets, it probably wasn't worth putting in a book.
Wow.
Yeah. Yoga.
And yoga.
Talk about yoga.
Yeah, yoga plays a huge role in my life. It's one of the great loves of my life, and it's featured in this book prominently. I practiced yoga before TC's assault, but I practiced it as exercise.
You were dressed, as I remember. It's incredibly poignant. You were ready to go to yoga class.
I was headed to hot yoga that morning. Yeah. And I do remember looking at myself in the mirror hours later in the hospital, just trying to make sense of everything. And I'm thinking, I'm still wearing my yoga clothes. And I couldn't get back on the yoga mat. I couldn't be by myself. I was terrified to get on my yoga mat because I had been surrounded by people for months, nurses and doctors and just everyone. The experience of being alone again, I knew was going to unravel me. So it took months, but I got back there. And what I discovered was that trauma doesn't live in the brain. It lives in the body. And I had been carrying it. And I could feel it. I could feel it in my shoulders. I could feel it every time I woke up in the morning. I could feel it. But through yoga and through the practice of the yoga philosophy, which I didn't know much about until I became a yoga teacher, I really began to work out that trauma, and I worked it out on a cellular level. I sweated it out. I shouted it out. I worked it out on this kind of little island of tears I describe at the end of the book, because it was still so much a part of what I was carrying around, and I had to free myself of it.
So the last few weeks, I would be talking to people about this podcast and who you're having on, and I would say to Abby Maslin, and they'd say, who's that? And I said, remember X years ago, this guy coming home from the Nats game, and everybody in D.C. knows that and remembers it. And they all say, so we'll ask you, how are they doing now?
Oh, my gosh. We're living a really busy, ordinary life. So when T.C. was in the hospital and he couldn't walk and he couldn't talk, my dream in life was to go to Target with him and wheel him in his wheelchair down the aisle of Target. Like, I thought that was as good as life might get, and I was okay with that. And now we live back on the hill.
You didn't want to go gambling in Monaco or anything?
No,
like that?
I mean, I couldn't dream that big at that point. I was like, Target, just get me to the dollar spot there. So, you know, right now life looks pretty much like it did before, with one huge exception, which is our almost three-year-old daughter, who we welcomed into this world in 2016. And so we're living this, you know, busy life of a working family, and we both have big jobs, very demanding jobs, and demanding kids. And there are all these subtle ways in which it's different, in which it will never be the same, whether it's the way that we communicate now, which is, you know, much more complicated and just kind of, it's just fascinating and challenging, and, you know, we drive each other crazy in new ways. But everything feels different on the granular level, mm-hmm. because everything about the world I'm looking at through new eyes. So that cup of coffee in the morning, which used to just be a cup of coffee, now I see it as just like this exquisite gift that I've been offered. And to look at life with that kind of sense of gratitude, it's hard not to feel joyful all the time. I'm so lucky. I do feel like the luckiest woman ever born. And some people would say, oh my gosh, look at what happened to you guys. How can this be possible? But I have a husband who is doing well, who went back to work 2.5 years after a terrible injury he shouldn't have even lived through. And we have two beautiful children. And I'm just always torn with how much am I allowed to ask for? Because I have everything. Am I allowed to even ask for more than that? Should wow. I?
Mm-hmm. We should just end the show now.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Really. What an inspiration you are, Abby.
Really, you know, it's Abby Maslin. The book is Love You Heart. I recommend everybody gets this book. And if you can, if you have a strong constitution, which I don't listen to the book because it's remarkable. But it is a remarkable memoir of marriage, brain injury, and reinventing love. Thank you so much for writing it. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break here and come back with a segment we call Deserted Island. We would love to have you participate.
Yes.
I didn't
Excellent.
Give you the homework in advance, but stay with us. We're back. I love that music. So we're back. We're still just in awe of Abby Maslin and her mm-hmm. book, and everyone should get this book. And I really don't know how to do a segue to this, and I really probably should have prepared this Deserted Island segment for a different featured author. But
Maybe.
today is the anniversary of the Hindenburg disaster.
It is what
disaster.
It is.
The
okay.
Hindenburg disaster, yeah.
Yeah.
36 people died. One of the most epic radio broadcasts ever, right?
I think
that's what really, yeah. yeah, really one of the most epic. So normally, Abby, in Deserted Island segment, we say, okay, if you got to go to Deserted Island by yourself, what's the one book you would take? And we did that for several weeks, and we got bored, and David and I ran out of books. So we come up with other things we'll do. So now I think, and I've got a really good one tonight. If you were going to take a book about a disaster, because you're on mm-hmm. a deserted island, it's a disaster. You might as well wallow
good.
In it, right, and find somebody who's gone through something more difficult. Mm-hmm. Michael, you're looking very serious. Would you like to go first?
Oh, you want to start with me tonight, Ms.
Yeah,
Clark?
I do.
So,
Professor?
No. Luckily, because...
20 minutes. I'm trying to watch my pre-derby prep stuff the other night, which I really enjoy, and I have to listen to 20 minutes of someone talking about how smart Michael Kornheiser
is. Well, of course
he
is. Well, we all know that.
The professor.
So, Walker is going through a big book phase where he's really big into Paddington. He's really into
scary.
Angelina Ballerina.
Paddington is scary.
He's not. Yeah. That's not scary.
He's lost. Angelina Ballerina.
Angelina
sure.
Ballerina. So I'm bringing up Angelina's Cinderella. The Mouse Tour is going through all of Mouseland performing Cinderella. And the final performance is going to be at Count Von Whisker's house. And along the way... The trailer turns over.
Yes.
Disaster.
Yeah.
So these friends have to come together. The show must go on. So I'm going to bring Angelina's Ballerina.
I love that. That was one of my daughter Devin's favorite books. Well, I think she
Beautiful
dressed
drawings.
As Angelina Ballerina for years.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably still is right now at Syracuse. Yeah.
If you want another answer, I've got Robinson Crusoe, but that's for another day.
Okay, another day.
So
whole island theme. Jeannie?
I was not here last week when you all
we
talked
you.
About what author you would take to a deserted yeah. island. So
you can do that quickly if you'd like.
Well, I'd want to do it quickly, and I'm like, are you guys crazy? I'm taking Sam Shepard because he is so
hot and
handsome.
A good writer.
Come
yeah.
on.
Good.
What? But for Disaster, I've mentioned this book before that I really love, and it's A Night to Remember by Walter Lord about
fabulous.
The sinking of the Titanic.
Sure.
I could read that 100. And still to this day, people say it's the most honest book written about the Titanic.
Yeah, good one. David?
Oh, my gosh. Jeannie, you're always making me feel bad about my choices here. It's kind of a story of my life. I thought about this for a while. There's a couple of books. One was And the Band Played On by Randy Schultz, which is about the early
yeah.
days of the AIDS
one.
Epidemic in the United States
yep.
and kind of how nobody got it right, including Randy Schultz, I think most people would say now. But that's okay because...
the importance of that book is that it was written for, with a point of view. And no matter what you think of his point of view, whether he got all the facts right, he had a point of view that was very clear and very necessary to hear at that particular point in time. But I actually thought about a book that I read a long time ago called it's called The Death of a President by William Manchester. And it's basically about John F. Kennedy being assassinated. It's about that entire weekend. And about everything that transpired. And the reason why it resonated with me is because after the book was written, after he did all the interviews, this was supposed to be kind of like the formal history of what happened according to the Kennedy family. And they subsequently said, you need to take some stuff out because there was a little too much stuff in there about Jackie smoking and other things that was going on. And he took some things out but left some things in. And it really is, I think, the correct portrayal of what it was like to be in that universe with that family at that time, dealing with the most surreal, traumatic, unbelievable thing that could possibly have happened. You know, I remember, I always think about this as is another book that I read that in early 63, the idea that Jack Kennedy was thinking about, and he was actually very serious about it, was going around the country with Barry Goldwater, because everybody knew Barry Goldwater was going to be the nominee in 64, and just going around the country and just talking, just the two of them, just talking about the issues.
How civil.
Goldwater came to meet Kennedy in the Oval Office at some point in 1963, and Kennedy looks up from this sheaf of papers that's 5 miles high and says, "You really want this bleeping job?"
You can have it.
You can have it. And so I just, it just reminded me that that was a different time than
I
when
like
people
that.
Actually sort of understood what the other person was thinking about.
You know, one of the greatest stories out of great yet sad yet incredibly profound whatever's out of JFK's assassination is Mary McGrory. Y'all remember Mary McGrory?
Yes.
You know, one of the great journalistic icons is in a room with Pat Moynihan, one of the great lions of the United States Senate of politics, fabulous guy, and she's just bemoaning what had happened and the tragedy of the country, and she says, "Oh my God, Pat, you know, will we ever laugh again?" And he looked at her and he says, "Yes, we'll laugh again. We'll never be young again." And you think about what it did to the country. Mark, are we going to give you a pass?
No,
Yeah, Mark is good.
Does it involve sunburn?
No.
Okay, that's four jokes you can have on sunburn. Just keeping track for those of you scoring at home.
Or scoring alone.
So books on disasters. I think any book that has been written about the Dan Snyder ownership era in Washington Redskins would definitely be something. But no, Sebastian Junger's book, The Perfect Storm.
That's a great book.
Sure. Yeah, and for those who have seen the movie, it's about the movie focuses on the fishing boat, the Andrea Gale. And a series of things happen, like there's a rogue wave, there's a shark that gets on the boat. Like that didn't actually happen. But he took stories of sailors at sea, fishermen, and like, "Oh, you got to hear this story. Oh my God, this one time this rogue wave got us." So they combined that all into the movie, but the way he wrote about it was so utterly compelling. And there were some things they took directly from the book they put in the movie, like when George Clooney says, "We're sailing in the 18th century right now," when they have no radar, they get nothing. And he does talk in pretty great detail about the final moments of the crew on that ship and what he would imagine what might have happened. And it was just brilliant. I mean, it's much different than the movie, but just such a great read. I recommend that very heartily.
We've had several people listen to this podcast say you've got to get Sebastian Junger on, which we would love to have him on. That book, I had that on my potential list. Abby, do you have one?
Oh, man. Well, I was going the Titanic route.
You have no time to read. You have no time to read.
I read a lot of young adult fiction. I was going to go A Night to Remember. So instead, I'm going to just pitch a book that I loved recently that you could consider our justice system kind of a disaster, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
So Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson.
Oh, yeah.
Such a powerful
book. Somebody sent
book.
That to us. Michael, did you give that? Somebody sent that to us, and we're trying to get that off.
Oh, my gosh. What an incredible book. And for me, having sat on one side of this in the justice system, and then to read about the other side, and as an educator, it was mind-blowing. So this is about the death penalty. Yeah. This is about wrongful conviction and making sure people get a fair chance in our justice system.
That's a very, very incredible good one.
New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, also. Fantastic book about the different,
as you said, different kinds of disasters. Mm-hmm. So mine is the classic disaster about the Johnstown flood by David McCullough.
Oh, sure.
Which he wrote many years ago. Do you guys know how he happened to write that book? Mm-mm. Which I'm from that part of the world. It is a remarkable story. The tragedy in which 2,200 people died, approximately 2,200, it could have been prevented. And it was all because these big, powerful, wealthy guys wanted their fishing and hunting and camping grounds to be better, so they rejiggered the river, but could have been prevented. This young guy named David McCullough is wandering through the Library of Congress and sees some photos out on a table. And they were incredible photographs from what had happened in the 1880s when this disaster occurred.
1899.
That got him going on the idea and got him to write the book. And he's done many interviews about it. It's probably his least successful book. But he says that's what made me an historian.
Yeah.
Really, really it's remarkable books. It was great. Okay, we're just in awe of Abby Maslin and your story and your outlook on life. Thank you so much for being with us. Everyone should get Love You Hard now. And everyone should come back next week when we have on Nevin Martell. I don't know what the word is to describe Nevin Martell, but he is the Renaissance man. Writes about cooking, writes about parenting, writes about all sorts of things. He co-authored a book with Jeannie's friend from Red Truck Bakery, who we want to
Ryan
have on
Noyes.
Someday.
Uh-huh.
And I think it'll be really, really fun. So come back in a week. Thanks, Abby.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.